Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello!
Hello. Seems like only a few days ago that we were together.
It does. We just did a live show on Sunday and now here we are in my loft. It's very hot today and I don't wish to get our listeners hot under the collar, but both Ed and I are wearing shorts.
You were wearing them last week, weren't you?
Yeah.
You were a trendsetter.
That's exactly how I think of myself.
I followed your trend.
Yeah. So in the days since we last saw each other, how have things been? What have you done?
Well, I did another turn actually with David Willetts, who we had on the podcast a few episodes ago, talking about what the tax system should be like after Brexit. How should we change the tax system after Brexit? And really what I was saying was that I felt very strongly that for lots of people who voted for Brexit, they voted for big change in terms of not just the obvious issues that lots of people talk about, but in terms of the way the system felt rigged in favor of people at the top. And if you were going to change the tax system, it should be to inject much greater fairness into the system. So Margaret Hodge has a committee on responsible taxation. So David Willetts and I went before that and we agreed about quite a lot, actually, not everything.
And did you wear shorts to that?
I was tempted, but I went for the suit and tie. Actually.
Is that frowned upon in Portcullis House and the various Houses of Parliament?
Well, I've edged towards the jeans and dark jeans and jacket if I'm not sort of doing a formal meeting or being in the House of Commons chamber for voting. I've even sort of done that. It's providing you don't go into the chamber, it's sort of all right.
Is that sort of the classic Clarkson look? Is that what we're talking about?
God,
here?
Is that the Clarkson look?
I think jeans and a jacket, maybe.
Larry Hagman. I don't have the cowboy hat. So because I don't love wearing suits. I really don't love wearing suits. Mm. I bet you don't like wearing suits either.
I do actually like wearing suits, but I rarely have occasion to. Mm. I think that's the thing, isn't it?
You'd be very welcome to wear a suit for this.
Of yours?
Can you? Well, no, I mean, for the
we'd probably have to have it let out a bit. Although I've started this week, I've decided I'm doing that 5-2 diet.
Are you?
You know the one where for 2 days a week you can only eat 600 calories and then every other day you eat as much as you physically can.
Are you doing it?
Yes.
Is it working?
It's going okay, yeah. I'm on a starving day today, but I'm really going to binge tomorrow.
God, I'm sorry. You seem pretty good humoured about it.
Yeah, let's see where I'm at by the end of the podcast.
No, that's true. Yeah.
So what are we talking about on this week's podcast?
So we're talking about ownership, so how company services are owned. And obviously, you know, you've got private ownership, you know, private profit-making companies, but you've got other forms of ownership. We're talking about those, public ownership, municipal ownership, but particularly what we want to focus on is cooperative ownership. And we're focusing on a part of Spain, the town of Mondragon, where, believe it or not, 73,000 employees, so a rather large number, are in cooperative firms. And it's got this extraordinary history. And we're talking to somebody from there. And then we're going to go a bit wider in terms of what are the implications of that for us here? Why might we be interested in other forms of ownership? You know, we've covered a bit public ownership, rail, in past episodes. But I think thinking about if you want to change the country, if you want to change the way things are run, what does it mean for these questions of ownership? I think, you know, there's obviously a rich tradition on this. I think it's kind of a really important subject.
Manchester, birthplace of the cooperative
exactly,
movement.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly.
Co-op used to have the headquarters on Balloon Street. I don't know if they still do. And as well as that, we have some other podcasters coming in to present ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful. They're very funny. Their live shows are a huge success, as is their podcast. We have Helen and Ellie from the Scummy Mummies podcast.
Great. What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful this week, I mean, I am finding it difficult to come up with a reason to be cheerful this week just because I'm hungry. So I'm starting to, you know, just get into that kind of hangry frame of mind. But here's one. I'm going to go and see Flight of the Conchords this week. Do you remember I got tickets for Sarah for Christmas?
Something happened.
And then it got cancelled because Brett from the band Brit, he broke his hand and couldn't play guitar. And it's been rescheduled.
So what is it, Flight of the Conchords?
You've never seen Flight of the Conchords? Oh, Ed, it's fantastic. It's an HBO sitcom from about 10 years ago. It's two Kiwi guys living in New York, sort of in abject poverty because they're trying to make it as musicians. And they're sort of very funny and very deadpan. But it's full of songs, and the songs are the best musical parodies and best musical comedy you can see. They're so, so good.
So should I go and watch it as well?
Absolutely, you should, yeah. Yeah. What's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, mine actually is about one of our episodes, sort of. What is now the famous episode on sortition, episode 20, you know, the idea of citizens, juries and so on. We've had this email this week from Sarah Allen from the organization involved. She was on the podcast that they got commissioned by the Health and Social Care, Housing Communities and Local Government Select Committees. That's two select committees to run their own citizens assembly on social care, because I think it's one of the issues we raised as an ideal. And they've released the findings. It recommended taxing the over 40s to pay for social care. So they got together 47 citizens to have in-depth discussions about these issues. And they came up with a preference for earmarked taxation and support for a separate compulsory social insurance payment for those over 40. They wanted social care to be free at the point of delivery, like the NHS. And they thought that there should be an extension of national insurance to be paid by people who work beyond state pension age. So at the moment, national insurance is only charged to working people below state pension age. So they've obviously come up with some ideas about how to sort out the social care mess that there is in this country. I think, and we'll talk about social care on a future episode, but I think what's really encouraging is you've got select committees of the House of Commons for the first time actually engaging in this. I think it deserves perhaps more attention than it's got, the fact that this has happened. But I definitely think it's a reason to be cheerful.
And it's all down to us.
Well, I'm not sure we can claim complete credit.
No, I think we can. I think we can claim complete credit for this.
Okay, fair enough.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
I'm delighted that we're now joined by Ander Echeverria, who is the Director of Cooperative Dissemination in Mondragon. And he's going to tell us about the Mondragon experience. Ander, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. You're welcome.
First of all, tell us a little bit about how Mondragon is different from most other towns in Spain or around the world in terms of the ownership and the cooperative ownership.
Yes, the town of Mondragon has more or less half of the workers in this town are cooperative workers, half of the workers. And this is because many cooperatives of the Mondragon group are located in this town or near this town. And what is Mondragon, the group? We are a group of 102 cooperatives. Cooperatives have subsidiaries around the world, 140 subsidiaries. Where we are working, in the cooperatives or in the subsidiaries, more or less 80,000 workers. And these cooperatives are autonomous cooperatives. That means that members are owners of the cooperative. Owner of the cooperative is not the government. Owner of the cooperative is not Mondragon, because cooperatives are autonomous. Owner of the cooperative is not a third part, but members of each cooperative are the owners. and they are working there. If you are a member of a cooperative in the Mondragon Group, you are working in that cooperative. Yes, we are workaround.
And how did it come about? What's the history?
So the beginning for our experience was 1941, when a priest called José María de Mendiarrieta came to the town of Mondragon. It was after the Civil War, a very tough situation, and he started to meet young people to organize different kind of activities, debate, culture, sport, young people whose parents were fighting in different sides. But these young people are together with the priest at Mendiarrieta organizing this kind of activities. This was since 1941. In 1943, the priest is going to set up a school that now is Mondragon University. And after years and years of education, training, and organization of different kind of activities, in 1956, they are going to set up the first industrial cooperative of our experience.
And how did it go from these beginnings to 80,000 workers, Ander?
The idea was to improve the society. And they understood that the best way was to create cooperatives. So if they are going to create more cooperatives, it's better than less cooperatives. So they started to do cooperatives in different fields of the economy. Schools, cooperative schools, housing cooperative, industrial, agricultural, a cooperative bank, cooperative university in universities today, technological research centers, cooperative, cooperative consultancies, all kind of cooperatives.
And what difference has this made to the people of Mondragon, this cooperative experience? How is would it be different from another town that you might visit either in Britain or in Spain or elsewhere?
If you take into account how are our cooperatives, so members are workers, one worker, one member, one vote, and how we share profits in a way that is not bigger than six times. I mean, the lowest payment is one, so the highest payment is maximum six. If we take into account this, and if we take into account that what we want to do is to create employment, to create jobs, because this is the way to do a better society, in the region of the town of Mondragon, where most cooperatives are located, in this region, usually we have the lowest ratio of unemployment of the whole Spain.
Wow.
If we are talking about regions in Spain. If we are talking about regions in Spain, this region usually has the highest ratio of investment in research and development of the whole Spain, because we want to continue existing. And this region, if we take all the regions in Spain, usually has the lowest economical inequality in Spain.
And can you talk to us about productivity?
Well, productivity is very interesting because there is no definitive study that shows that cooperatives are better or are not better than other companies. What we can say, and this is something empirical, that many of our cooperatives are in their markets in the top five or in the top three. So we have to be very, very efficient if we want to implement our principles and our values. If we want to continue existing, we must be very efficient. And the reality shows that most of our cooperatives are very efficient and they are in their markets in the top five or in the top three.
And if you think about decision-making in a company, what in a cooperative company in Mondragon, Ander, how would that be different from a normal private enterprise? Is it much more democratic decision-making? How does that work?
In our case, we take the most important decisions once per year in the General Assembly. And in the General Assembly, one member, one vote. To take the decision, sometimes we need more time than it would be in another kind of company. But if we need time, that means that once the decision is taken, it's much easier to implement this decision if we compare in a company that the decision is taken from the top, and then you have obstacles to implement this decision.
And this is a general assembly of each company, is it, or of the whole of Mondragon?
We are 102 cooperatives. Cooperatives are autonomous, and each cooperative has its general assembly. And then we are a group. Each cooperative is part of the group, so we have a general assembly of Mondragon Group, and the name of this general assembly is the Congress.
How did the companies in Mondragon fare during the economic crisis, which afflicted so many other countries, you know, about 10 years ago?
Well, the crisis has been a very big crisis, and we have faced the crisis with using different ways. One way was or has been that we had money, we had funds to face the crisis because we were saving money in good periods. Another way is in each of our cooperatives, well, the traditional recipe to work more hours and to have a lower salary. This is something that we take or we adopt these decisions in a non-traumatic way.
So people were willing to make sacrifices for the company, you mean?
Yes, because it's your future. It's your future. And if someone is going to save you, it's you. It's not going to be, I don't know, a third part. No, you are responsible of your company, of your cooperative, and so you have to take decisions thinking that it's your company. One of the big commitment or great commitment in our group is that if I'm a member in a cooperative and I have no work, I have the right to work in another cooperative. If there is no work in the group, I have the right to be trained. And if still there is no work in the group for me, I have the right to get an unemployment salary for 2 years.
From the cooperative association?
From Mondragon Group. In our history, no one worker has extinguished this 2 years period of unemployment salary.
Amazing. Mondragon is an extraordinary experience, Ander, but if you like, you're an island in a sort of sea of capitalism.
Yes.
How much pressure does the rest of the sort of capitalist system put on you? I mean, I can imagine other companies trying to undercut you with lower wages, less benefits for their workers, you know, less environmental standards. How much of a constraint, a pressure, an obstacle is that for you?
That's a good question. I don't know what to say. I'm working here since 20 years ago and living in this environment. And what can I say is that if you are working with us, you have reasons to work with us in the way of your heart and in the side of your heart and in the side of your pocket. In the side of your heart, if you understand that work is the way to develop yourself, I'm working and I'm developing my skills, my competences, and I become an integral person. So a cooperative is a better environment to reach this integrity as a person. This is important. What is also important, if I'm working in a cooperative, I'm working for me, I'm working for my colleagues, and I'm working for this region. I'm not working for a person to be in the list of Forbes number 5. Yes? I'm working for me, for my colleagues, and for the region. And this is a special sensation. So this is in the side of our heart and in the side of the pocket. If you are working in a cooperative, your salary, if you are not a boss, your salary is going to be the same or better than outside. And if you are working in a cooperative, well, laid off doesn't exist. You are not going to be fired. Employment stability is very important. And if we remember Maslow, the pyramid of Maslow, stability, security is fundamental for all of us.
And if we're thinking about the United Kingdom and what we should learn from the work you've done, and we wanted to create our own Mondragon, what steps would we need to take, do you think? What's your advice to us?
I'm not an expert in the United Kingdom, but I would say my impression is that also here, cooperativism is not very known. It's not very known. We have to make known cooperativism around the world, because usually cooperatives are seen as subsidized companies producing not very important services or products, depending on the government. We must present cooperatives as efficient companies, and so cooperatives are an option. I think that is the best option, but people have to know that there is another option, and it's to create cooperatives.
Ander, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
We're joined by Joe Guinan, who is Senior Fellow at the Democracy Collaborative and Executive Director of their Next System project. Joe, thanks for coming.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us about the work you do related to alternative models of ownership, because that's our subject for today's podcast.
Absolutely. I think most people don't really understand the extent to which there's been a quiet ownership revolution taking place sort of beneath the surface of media attention in the United States. For example, one in every three Americans is a member of a co-op of one form or another, whether that's credit or consumer co-ops or even a small handful of worker co-ops. There's exploding innovation at the community level in terms of new community ownership forms, community development corporations, community land trusts, which I understand you've talked about on past shows. Also, a surprising prevalence of municipal ownership, local public ownership, which I think, again, people may not be fully aware
of. What kind of things would that be, municipal ownership?
That could be everything from providing the usual services that haven't been outsourced in the United States to the extent to which they have here, sort of bins and water and energy, through to profit-making businesses. You're finding more and more cities are actually doing things like when they put in new transport infrastructure and the land values go up, instead of seeing private developers capturing all that, they're capturing it themselves by owning the hotels that are built and so forth and then leasing them out.
Even public Wi-Fi, I think I'm right in saying. Is that
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. You're seeing parts of the states where some of the big Wi-Fi companies haven't been present and haven't been delivering good services, providing new publicly owned broadband. In fact, some of the fastest broadband in the United States is publicly owned in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
And just for our listeners, we've heard about Mondragon. It all sounds good. Why might the people listening to this podcast think, or why would you say, that these models of ownership need to be explored?
Well, I think you were tackling some of these questions when you were talking about pre-distribution. It's an ugly word for a very important concept of the importance of how the economy is structured and its basic relationships and the outcomes that that produces. And what we've seen through the sort of history of social democracy has been an attempt to correct for malign outcomes.
Through taxes and benefits and so on.
Absolutely, the welfare state. Whereas I think what these new models of ownership and the democratic economy are really about are getting those institutions and relationships right from the get-go so that they naturally, in and of themselves, as a matter of course, produce the kind of outcomes that we're looking for in terms of broader ownership, better income distribution, sustainability, and economics of place, and so forth. And I think more and more people are gravitating in this direction. It's happening here in the United Kingdom in a very exciting way as well.
Can you talk through some of the ways it's happening over here?
My colleague, Matthew Brown, who recently became leader of Preston.
Who we've had on the podcast.
Absolutely. It's a very good episode. He has really taken some of the ideas of Mondragon, but also some of the work that we've done in Cleveland, Ohio with the Evergreen co-ops, and begun to build what I think is starting to amount to a 21st century model of municipal socialism in which there are different ownership models and forms, co-ops attached to local anchors and procurement. You probably went into all that with your show.
So this is the local public sector bodies like the NHS and the police and so on commissioning services but from and supplies from cooperatives.
Exactly. And so creating, if you like, a sort of rooted economy of place that's somewhat protected from global capital flows and predatory multinational corporations and the like. And we've seen this recently in Cleveland, where our tiny little co-ops that got started there have really started to expand and take on bigger and bigger contracts. And
in what kinds of areas?
So there's three co-ops. There's a large urban greenhouse providing leafy greens and herbs to the local hospitals and universities. There's a laundry, as you can imagine. Hospitals produce very large dirty linen output, and that needs to be laundered by someone or other. And then we've got a solar and weatherization company and more companies down the road. But the laundry is just stepped in and taken on the entire laundry service contract for the Cleveland Clinic, one of the bigger and most well-known hospitals in the United States, doubled their number of workers and put them on a fast track to ownership. Everyone got a pay increase as part of that contract as well. And so I think things are going well there. In Preston, you're seeing some even more interesting additions. The bank, the cooperative bank that is in the process.
That's not the co-op bank. That's a new cooperative bank in Preston.
Small C cooperative.
Yeah, called Small exactly. C cooperative.
Yeah. So the Preston Bank is in the process of being created. If you look at the dominance in the UK of the handful of very, very large banks and what they're actually up to, only a very, very tiny amount of their lending actually goes to small and medium businesses in this country. And most of it actually goes into speculative trading and derivatives and all the kinds of things that brought about the last financial crash. And they, you know, they're extracting wealth and extracting money from communities. What we're trying to build with new banking models is ways of providing basic, boring banking services to small businesses and residents in a way that just recirculates those profits, keeps the investment local, and builds the economy that way.
What is a co-op? I mean, we know the word and we've got an idea of it, but how does it work logistically, setting up a co-op and operating, and what are the benefits for not employees, but I guess the stakeholders, right?
So a co-op is a business or an enterprise that, instead of being privately held or owned and publicly traded on the stock market, is held either by its workers or its consumers or some group of stakeholders. And this is a model that dates back to Rochdale, to the foundational principles. There are other forms of milder, if you like, employee ownership that don't meet the strict co-op test.
But it's got to be reasonably equitable to sort of qualify as a co-op.
Yes.
And do you see a big distinction in terms of the sort of social impact, the impact on workers and so on, between co-ops on the one hand and other forms like what they call social enterprises? So that's sort of businesses but founded for a social purpose, or, you know, businesses that operate with a sort of big conscience, you know, give some of their profits away. Is there a bright line between them?
It depends who you ask. But for me, I think what's exciting about the current moment is the plurality of ownership forms that are developing. In some circumstances, it makes perfect sense to have a very pure co-op of, you know, one member, one vote ownership by the workers or the consumers or whatever. In other circumstances, it may make more sense to run something as a non-profit or to run it as a social enterprise where it has a mission baked into its bylaws and governance, but doesn't necessarily have to follow the, you know, the pure ownership models. In some circumstances, it makes sense for things to be run by the public and owned by the public. In others, the community or communal ownership, the commons, is the more appropriate model. And I think, you know, we're moving away from that old Cold War binary of public-private and seeing that actually there's a whole array of ownership forms in between that can be experimented with and applied in different circumstances.
And I know this is an incredibly basic question for you, but you cited some models of co-ops both here and in the US. What's the advantages of that?
Well, I think, as you've seen, the economy concentrate into fewer and fewer hands in terms of the ownership of wealth, more and more income is flowing from capital ownership rather than from labor. Wages have been stagnant, but returns to capital have been going up. You know this. Piketty's work has been very important in laying this out. And if you project this forward into the future, it looks very bleak, wealth concentrating in fewer and fewer hands. What you're doing with a co-op or other forms of employee ownership is spreading the ownership of that wealth. This is something that's had appeal across the political spectrum for a long time, from John Stuart Mill even through to Ronald Reagan, and even Margaret Thatcher talked about a property-owning democracy. It never happened. But co-ops are one way of actually making it happen, spreading ownership of capital, giving people ownership of their jobs, rooting them in communities and place. If you're a member of a co-op, you tend not to export your own job to China or overseas. You tend to also be more concerned about the environmental impacts of your practices and your production on the local community, which you're an owner of in the sense of the company, but also living in. And your children are drinking the water and breathing the air and so on. So it's a more embedded form of ownership, in contrast with what we've got, which is a very disembedded form of ownership in terms of the publicly traded corporation. People own companies for milliseconds. There's so much churn that's going on. There's no real ability, therefore, to build stewardship of land, of thinking about carbon and so on over the long term.
And you've got a project called the 50 by 50 project.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
So what 50 by 50 is an attempt to expand the employee ownership sector of the United States from where it is now, which is about 10 million worker owners, mostly in employee stock ownership plans, a handful of worker co-ops. That's actually already more members than are in members of unions in the private sector in the United States. There's already a sizable employee ownership sector compared to that declining union density. But what we're trying to do is massively expand that. We have set upon the idea that if there's a company in a sector of a certain size that is cooperatively owned or owned by its employees, there's no reason why all the other comparable companies in that sector couldn't similarly be owned in that way. And so we projected out from the existing base and figured out that we could certainly have a much larger base of employee ownership, 50 million worker owners by 2050. Personally, I'd have liked to have seen 25 by 25, but I'm always in a hurry. So I lost that one.
That's good. That's good. And what are the obstacles to this? Because it sounds, I don't know what Jeff thinks, but it, you know, when you listen to what you're saying, when you listen to what Anda was from
Sounds great, but how do you go from it being
where we are?
Yeah,
the world of Amazon and, you know, Google and everything, which are certainly not co-ops, to the world you want to build, I guess.
Sort of like aside from going and getting a job at John Lewis's, like what's the route for people listening who are thinking, I really like the idea of an economy that bases more on this model? You know, how do we get to there?
So there's a couple of different paths that we can take forward. The thing that we've seized upon is what's being known increasingly as the silver tsunami. What the silver tsunami is this wave of retiring baby boomer business owners who built their companies and are now at the point where they're retiring, they want to sell them on. Often their children aren't all that interested in running them. Many of them will just close down if they can't find a buyer. Others will be gobbled up by hedge funds and assets stripped and thrown away. And so the idea is to seize upon this sort of generational transfer of ownership, to really try and convert as many of those boomer businesses to employee ownership as is possible.
So this will be the employees buying out the existing...
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the employees are going to need finance for that. And that's one of the areas that we're focusing on. It's not so easy for banks when they look at the employees rather than a hedge fund to assess creditworthiness and so on and so forth. And so there's some work needs to be done there. But, you know, employee-owned businesses, co-ops, are small businesses just like others and are eligible for many of the small business grants and loans and financial assistance and state and local policy support that's available. So how do we tap into that is one question we're looking into.
And that would extend to raising the capital to buy it in the first place.
Exactly. I mean, we in Evergreen created co-ops from the ground up, and believe me, it was incredibly hard. I didn't do the work. Colleagues did the work. But the opportunity to flip an already viable business and put that into the hands of its employees when it's already got markets, when it's already got relationships, etc., is very appealing. And there'll be a much lower failure rate than, yeah, than trying startups.
Because these are the people who've made the businesses a success in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And presumably, if a government like the Jeffocracy bought your argument and wanted to at least provide some incentive for the transformation of the economy, they could with the tax system. I mean, this is an area where if you gave tax advantages, for example, for people doing this or people selling on their businesses, it's pretty responsive to this. So with a government with the right will.
Correct. And in fact, you know, this is where the legislation that created the possibility for ESOPs came from. It was a recognition.
Just say what ESOPs are.
Employee stock ownership plans. This is in the United States.
Joe, this all sounds great, but what are the obstacles to doing this on a big scale in a capitalist economy?
I think there are a number of obstacles, finance being one of the immediate ones. It's not obvious what the creditworthiness of the owners is. It's not obvious that the company will be on a growth trajectory in quite the way that an ordinary capitalist company would be, and so forth. Co-ops themselves also don't tend to expand in the way that ordinary companies do. They're not as growth-oriented. They're often happy to just keep taking over, which is a useful function maybe for a company.
Because there isn't that profit incentive for the individual, for the entrepreneur?
Well, because you get to a certain point with certain returns and certain working hours where you'd rather go home to your kids, yeah, and family and do other things rather than make an extra pound. So some of it is hardwired into the form, I think. Some of it is cultural. They're just not a natural fit. They're an oddity and seen as, you know, maybe fringe, a little bit hippie or a little bit happy-clappy and not a real business. But I think people are starting to gravitate more and more towards them and be curious about them because the current system and the current businesses that we have are so obviously broken and not serving social and economic needs and so on that there's an openness to thinking about something different. And turns out that, you know, the something different might have been around all along. You know, the UK invented co-ops and, you know, going back to Rochdale, maybe a bit like football, maybe co-ops will be coming home.
We've got this thing called the Jeffocracy, which is Jeff as a benign-ish dictator. If he were to say to you, okay, you've got a year, we're normally not that generous, we can normally say 100 days, but you've got a year, you've got the run of the government to have this revolution, to have the British 50 by 50, what would you do?
The first thing I'd do would be dramatically increase the technical assistance available for the other Matthew Browns, the other leaders of Labour councils that could start to move those local institutions.
Or any council, or any party.
Any councils, yeah, any party. And get them to really start procuring from local businesses, but in particular co-ops. And there's, you know, a lot of analysis needs to be done on where the gaps are. Where are there not small businesses that could then be created that could displace some of these big, you know, the Carillions and the Capitas and, yep, and all those.
Yep.
I would steal the right to own from John McDonnell. I think you could outflank him on this maybe and take that policy and make it really, really strong.
To say what the right to own
the
is?
The right to own is the idea that if a company comes up for sale or is being closed down, then the employees should have the right of first refusal to mm-hmm. purchase that company. Mm-hmm. So rather than the hedge fund swooping mm-hmm. in and asset stripping it. And, you know, one of the things that I would try and figure out in that first year is how to expand this opportunity as far as possible, even beyond those companies that are either going to the wall or being handed over and sold, so that you could start to tap into the rest of the companies in the economy as well, provide incentives for maybe shares of companies to go to the employees. They don't have to own them all. There's different degrees of employee ownership that would be possible. There's a great example of this in the US not long ago. Chobani, the yogurt company, you may not have heard of it. I don't know if they have sales over here, but it was closely held, privately owned, not publicly traded. And when it was about to be put on the public markets, the owner allocated 10% of the company to the employees. So suddenly you'd been working in Chobani, you know, getting your probably decent wage, but suddenly you're an asset owner as well. Really interesting. You start then to create the political dynamics that would support the Jeffocracy into the future, a bit like what Thatcher did with council houses and so on.
Great. Joe, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what do you think?
I'm more convinced than I was when I started. Don't get me wrong, I've always loved the idea of cooperatives, but you think of them as something a bit woolly and hippie-ish and something that lives outside of the mainstream economy.
I agree.
But it's just so interesting to me that they're springing up.
Like in laundry, food. Yeah. I think that's what's sort of very revelatory about
it.
Yes,
yeah.
And it's not in a marginal part of the economy. I've probably used this phrase before, but Oscar Wilde said the problem with socialism is it takes too many evenings. And, you know, I suppose there's that worry about it, but it doesn't feel like that. It feels like, you know, well, this is a way that your workers can be paid a better wage. You know, the profits can be more fairly spread. You can be more productive. I mean, you know, I think it's pretty exciting.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do share your thoughts on what you've heard, or if you have ideas for people we could talk to on future podcasts, you can email us. reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. You can tweet us at Cheerful Podcast or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/reasons to be cheerful podcast. Have this from Tom Smith, who says, I just finished the episode on gender equality in the workplace and STEM. I am an assessor for apprentices in engineering, and I'm happy to say that we do try and encourage equality, and I'm happy to say that I do have a number of female apprentices. Sadly, it's not anywhere near the 50-50 split we would like, but we're slowly increasing the numbers of females into engineering and construction jobs. I was really pleased to hear you talk about pushing quality, not only for women in male-heavy industries, but also pushing to get more men into female-heavy industries. I'm often on training courses with assessors from other industries and was shocked to talk with one in the dental and hygiene sector who said that in the 20 years she's worked at the college, they've never had a male dental nurse apprentice. Wow. I do feel a lot is being done, but more could be done to push females into stereotypically male jobs. Emphasis should be on removing any gender stereotype to a job and not have pink and blue jobs, as Theresa May has mentioned about putting bins out, just jobs that need doing.
Next one is from Zach Keane about Silicon Valley surfs. Last week's episode, dear Jeff, your topic was very interesting. You both talked about experiencing rejection and loneliness as teenagers, which anyone will say are perfectly normal feelings. That said, can you imagine if Dallas was frequently interrupted with statistics on your perceived popularity? No, I can't. Social media sites and apps are very engaging pieces of technology. It seems for vulnerable children there is no break. Of course, social media isn't all bad, but with the documented rise in mental health issues experienced by young people, we shouldn't bury our heads in the sand. Keep up the brilliant work. You brighten up my Monday. The next one is also on the same subject. It comes from Alistair Mitchell, or at Digitally Ali, from Edinburgh. He thinks we didn't have enough young people in our tech overload discussion, Jeff, and I don't think he includes you in young people.
Right, because we did have me in there to make up the quota, but yeah.
As someone who recently left the young person demographic 26, I have to say I found the latest episode on protecting kids from tech overload quite patronising. If you had a young person on to discuss with them, I think a better discussion could have been had. I feel a lot of the bad habits come down to parents. The technology restricting settings which were discussed do exist in parental settings, but there isn't enough knowledge about them. He goes on to say that when he was growing up, he was surrounded by TV, video games, both console and portable, texting and in the later stages, YouTube, Facebook, but my parents didn't allow this during homework study periods and also beyond a certain time at night or during family time. He agrees with lots of the points about not harvesting data from children, and he'd be very interested to see if the design of these apps would change if there wasn't any monetary incentive to getting people under 18 to use them. He says the minimum age for Facebook, Snapchat, and Instagram is currently 13. Perhaps this should be higher and enforced by government or the EU. And then he's got some tips for us as a millennial.
Great.
Learning etiquette and good practice with my phone is key to everyday life. Here are my top tips. Don't check your phone when someone else is with you. Especially
during
dinner.
I was checking my phone. I missed that one.
It's the height of rudeness. 2, phone chargers in another room from where I sleep. That's hard. 3, notifications are defaulted to off. Except for iMessage, so no Facebook or WhatsApp groups going off constantly. Mm-hmm. Uninstall social media apps. I've done this except for Twitter, but notifications are off. This has made the time I spent on the phone far more productive, and I also get terrific battery life too as a bonus. Really enjoy the podcast, and previous representation of young people has been greatly appreciated. Keep up the good work.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
And here to pitch some ideas which could be potential reasons for cheerful, we're joined by Helen and Ellie from the Scummy Mummies podcast. Hello.
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 You did that much better the second time, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, the first one was a disaster.
Yeah, terrible.
Just, Helen and Ellie is sort of difficult.
Well, Ellie's real name is Ellen. So we could have been
Ellen and Helen.
Yes, that's obviously the television show.
So have you ever come across the Scummy Mummies podcast, Ed?
I've heard of it. I've heard only good things about it.
Great.
Oh.
Ellie hasn't listened to your podcast either, so you guys...
and thank you, Helen, for raising
points. I think it's just good to sort of surface.
This is
an honest space.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So how long has it been going then?
Five years.
Yeah.
And talk to me about when you go out and do live shows, which is like hugely popular.
They are hugely popular. Thanks for saying that.
They are. I mean, you've been doing them for a while, but I'm guessing the audience is there... because those early stages of parenthood, you're so cut off from the world and you can be filling this time between sort of 4 and 6 in the morning or whatever.
Yeah.
You must be heroes to these people.
Yeah, we are. That's what we like to say. We're heroes for the mothers. So we tour the Scummy Mummy Show around the UK and we wear gold cat suits and we now have new cat suits which are pink.
That's
whichever.
What we've been missing out on.
Gold cat suits.
We usually give our podcast guests cat suits, but I just thought today is not the day.
It's too hot.
But when we come on your live show, when you'll invite us on, we'll bring them. I thought that on stage. But yeah, so we toured around the country and it's amazing. Like there was women, we did it in Brighton last night and there were women who hadn't been out for ages and they had jugs of cocktails on the
inspire people to drink. That's what we're saying. That's the kind of heroes.
What do you talk about on the podcast?
Because the podcast and the live show are quite different. So the podcast, ostensibly, it's about parenting. But of course, you know, it inevitably sort of devolves into all sorts of things. And we have guests on to talk about everything from wine to books to travel to their experiences of being a single parent or IVF or so sometimes parenty things.
Yeah.
But mainly it's filth and swearing, to be honest. Yep. That's the main theme.
Silly games, silly songs. Yep. And we always end our podcast with Scummy Mummy Confessions. So everybody who's on our podcast has to give a story of parenting failure. And that's the one thing that links to the live show. The live show is like sketches and songs, more cat suits.
Yeah.
And then we have a live Scummy Mummy Confessions. And we've collected thousands of them from around the UK. So we've got this amazing shed full
a map of scum.
Yes, like a snapshot of Mother Britain, really.
And of course, they're funnier than
is
anything.
Is it only mummies?
Right.
No. Sometimes we have at least 4 men in our audience of 500 and they have a great time. We had one man.
Yes, one man last night. Yes, he was very pleased when I started talking to him in the audience.
Thrilled.
He was absolutely
thrilled
over the moon
with his life choices.
Yes.
But that's
they're not on the pool.
We did a show in Tunbridge Wells and there were some sort of men who got, I think from the local pub, who got wind that there were all these women clattering about about incredibly drunk in white wine on high heels and sort of wandered over and tried to get in. And the doorman was like, no, mate, it's not for you.
So you've brought along some ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful.
Yes. We bought thousands, actually.
So let's rattle through. Let's see what you got.
Would you like to go first?
Sure. So the first one is, we think maternity leave, we think, first of all, the name of it should be changed, because leave is like something you usually talk about when you're talking about a holiday or something like this. And in fact, someone I used to work with when I was pregnant described my maternity leave as a biological holiday. And I made that face you're making now.
Yeah.
I mean, so, it's more like a prison sentence with hard labour.
Well, exactly. So we thought, what about calling it maternity service? Because you are serving.
Yes.
You're serving your child. Obviously, but actually, you're serving society. I'm on
maternity
service.
And I think that will change perceptions. Because with men, paternity leave still, I think, is a big, you know, big hurdle we have to get over. So if they're saying, I'm doing my paternity service.
That's good. Mm. It does sound a bit, what's the right word? Sort of like an obligation rather than a...
It is an obligation.
I mean, you can't just do a few days and go, oh, I don't fancy this much.
No. Yeah, I suppose that's true.
It's a life sentence.
But that's the great thing about your podcast. You're talking about this stuff in an honest way. Instagram is full of feeds of people with their perfect babies and how happy they are with their posh prams and things. But, you know, of course, that is part of it, but it's just...
Not all of it.
No.
Okay, well, we buy it, I think. Maternity service.
Yes, and with that should come free coffee, because you get free vitamins because you're breastfeeding or whatever.
Free dental, which is weird.
Yes, but you should also get free coffee, free biscuits, and a free pass to use a toilet anywhere without having to buy a muffin, because that's a big problem.
I bought a lot of guilt muffins when the child needs the toilet, and you're like, I'll just buy a muffin. And yeah, I think women should just go straight in, shouldn't they?
Yeah.
Definitely. And flexible working, I think, should be mandatory.
Oh, yeah. I like that we put that after the coffee and the biscuits.
Yes,
And the toilet.
And the
toilet.
Also,
flexible working should be obligatory.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ding dong.
And if your work won't give you flexible working, you should be allowed to bring the baby to work with you and see how that goes for about 2 days.
See how long it takes for them to
give you flexible work. No, fine. You work from home. Yeah. You take that screaming.
Great. I think
we buy the whole
policy.
Package.
We're having
great.
It.
Great. Maternity service done. What should we do next, Ellie?
Right. This is my one.
She's got angry voice. You've gone your angry Peckham voice.
Are we allowed to swear?
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's go.
Do you want to know what Ed's favourite swear word is?
Oh.
Where's my favourite swear word?
I don't know. I should have gave you.
I do now.
Oh, no.
I thought you were going to say crumbs.
That is one of Ed's favourite.
I like that one.
Is it extreme as it gets.
Burke.
Burke, that's a good one.
Yeah,
actually.
It's not used enough
Burke.
These days. No, it's fallen out of favour.
I did use Wazzock the other day.
A couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
Who are we talking about?
Jeff.
Good stuff. So this policy is dog shit ID microchipping. Right? Because it drives me. I live in Southeast London and there is, I live on the school run. There's a lot of dog shit on the way to school and it drives me and all the other parents and I'm sure all the other people absolutely bonkers. So I haven't exactly worked the science out, but someone's going to be able to. I'm not a science person. No. Someone has to do it. You should be able to put a microchip in the dog food so that when the dog shits, the shit is
tiny,
traceable.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I agree dog shit is a problem, but it's quite a lot of business. I mean,
can you attach a stencil to their arseholes so that they sort of shit QR codes.
Yes,
QR codes.
Yes,
and then just hold your phone over the shit.
Yes,
and then
that contracts to the owner.
Yeah.
And what was the punishment we thought?
The punishment. So when you've caught the owner of the dog, who's let the dog crap on the pavement, the punishment, because obviously fines don't work, the punishment should be they have to go to a soft play centre after a bank holiday, a rainy bank holiday weekend, and clean out the nappy bins.
Oh.
That is an apt punishment.
Yeah.
And someone's
excellent
got to
punishment.
Do it. It's like community service. It's got to be done. Why should the people?
As opposed to maternity service.
You're getting on board. I like it.
That definitely is a punishment that fits the crime, I think.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I can tell from your face, which
no, I sort of agree.
Best described as a grimace.
I'm kind of halfway there. I'm halfway there.
Half aren't you on board with? The stenciled shaped anuses.
I sort of agree about the problem. I'm not sure government has the bandwidth. Well, with Brexit and everything for the old microchipping of the poo.
You need to think outside the box.
You do, yeah.
What do you got next?
The next thing is relationship MOTs, and that anybody in a relationship has to renew it every year, and that you have to get everything checked so it's in balance.
Okay, well, Jeff, you know what that means. We're coming up for our year.
We are.
Exactly. Because you're pod wives like me and Ellie.
We need to have a We need to have an MOT. What's part? What happens in the MOT?
Well, you know, like reassessing, is there equal chores? Yeah. Who's putting the bins out? Are they going in the right direction? All your working parts? How often you're having sex? All that sort of stuff.
Yes.
What,
when did
cooking?
You two last do it?
I mean,
not often enough.
Yeah,
really.
No. I just can't remember.
I know, we've been
how bad
there.
Things are.
Yeah. You need to go on a holiday together and, you know, reconnect.
I've suggested it.
See, stuff like this. This is what it's about.
An MOT. So you just go and get a little MOT, and then you can carry on for another year.
Or you have to get divorced. It's up to you.
Yeah, it's like an anniversary. You start being better. Mm. So if you knew that every year you had to get it checked, there would be less complacency, I think. Mm.
Well, there's also less sense of crisis because you're due for your MOT anyway. So it's not like it goes years and years with it all being bottled up.
Yeah.
Not that I'm not talking only about me and Jeff here. And then it all comes out at the wrong moment.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is gonna be better for society. What do you reckon?
Done.
Good.
Yeah, I'm into this.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Good.
Could you find someone for me and Jeff, please?
Yeah, we'll do that. And now, should we go on to badgers?
Yes. So.
Oh, be very careful here.
Why?
Badgers are a sore point with Ed.
Oh, why?
He has a paranoia.
Do I look like a badger?
He looks like a badger.
No, badger. Badgers. She's from Australia.
Badgers. Badgers.
Badgers.
Badgers.
Badgers.
It's like a trigger word for him. You went
badgers. Well, Jeff was sensitive to my trigger.
Yeah. Oh, God. So, you know, pins.
So badges then.
So specifically, so you know, like Transport for London.
Lapel pins.
Gives out these. They give out baby on board.
They do, yes.
Badges, which are, you know, they give you when you're pregnant. Yeah. And the idea is that you
good,
wear
actually.
Them. Yeah, people give you a seat on the tube, or they're supposed to, and they usually do unless they're wankers.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Yeah.
But we should have badges for other reasons that people need a seat on the tube.
Badges.
So along with baby on board, you should have a badge that says, you know, I need a seat. It's my birthday, or bad period,
or bad hangover.
Yes, or just ill-fitting shoes.
Mm.
Or I'm feeling windy. It's best for everyone if I sit down. Things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Or I need a badge because I often get offered a seat and I'm not wearing a badge and I'm not even pregnant. So I just take it because I'm not an idiot. But I just need one that says just fat.
Or what about instead of baby on board, cheese on board?
Yeah, exactly. Like avoid those awkward conversations.
You could sort of pick them at the tube station.
Maybe they're single use somehow. You only get, because you can't have a hangover every day. Well, it depends.
Yeah. I mean, maybe 5-6 times a year for a hangover. That's enough. Yeah. Birthdays, you know, Christmas do's, etc. And that's your limit.
Yeah.
You could sort of experiment with them. Real time experiment. You could produce the badges and then people could see whether it. The badges and see whether it and see whether it and see whether
don't
it,
produce badges on
the
tube. No, I've been
people
there.
Wearing badges on
nightmare.
The tube that is going to be traumatic. Yeah. Bulk on board. And I wasn't talking about you. I was just saying in general.
We're putting that on our poster.
But bulk on board. There must be some other ones which are like baby on board. It's got to feel like it's sort of you know,
badger on board.
Badger on board.
Just leave it. Yeah. And you got one last one for us.
Yes, we've got one last one, which is companies who donate to political parties should have to put that on their packaging. So if you're buying a packet of crumpets, it should say Tory crumpets. So that if you don't want to eat Tory crumpets,
yes, that's right.
You don't have to. You can just buy a different brand. We all know which brand we're talking about.
We do. Or, you know, clothes and things like that. You don't want to buy Tory clothes.
Some of our listeners might.
But equally, it works the other way. If you do want to buy a Tory crumpet, then you can go ahead and do that. You can make that choice actively.
Yeah. Yeah, so many things are political acts these days. Now I'm worrying about eating crumpets.
I think
welcome.
It's good. I like the idea, actually. But it's like a health warning.
Yes.
Yeah, let's, you want to know where your money's going, don't you?
Yeah, exactly.
So transparency. We're into transparency, aren't we?
I think so.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll have that too.
Great.
So the podcast is out every week.
Every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks.
Scummy Mummies,
And we're touring up and down the country with our show and our cat suits.
Yeah. It's all on scummymummies.com, all the tickets, all the jazz. Yeah. And we have a book, which is still in print.
Exactly. Yeah.
You said that like you expected it to go out of print very quickly.
Every day.
Every day. We just check Amazon. No, it's still there.
Yeah.
30,000 in the charts. That's it.
Great.
Ellie, Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So here we are in the outro.
Yes. And we're both going to be on another station next week.
Although separately.
Separately.
So in a strange turn of events.
Twist of fate.
Ed and I are both going to be on Radio 2 next week. You've got me with a, you know, two-decade plus career in radio behind me. And I will be mumbling around midnight and the midnight slot. And then you've got Ed, who, because he's got a bit of public profile, just wanders straight into a daytime slot.
So I'm going to be presenting Jeremy Vine for 3 days next week, which I'm obviously very flattered to be doing. But I'll definitely be listening to you.
Maybe I'll make a trail and you can play it during your program.
Yeah, that's true.
So if I can get
know you don't have that much say, honestly. Let me tell you, you're tightly managed. Being the little lone pot is nothing compared to the tight management and necessary management on the Jeremy Vine program.
So we should thank our guests.
Yes, I'd like to thank Joe Guinan and Anda Echeverria.
And very impressive pronunciation, by the way.
I took a run at it.
Yeah, I know, but you would never have known. I mean, it was right, really good. Very thanks. Competent. I'll thank Ellie and Helen from the Scummy Mummies podcast. Emma Corsham produces our podcast brilliantly every week with backup and research from Alex Feisbrice and Lindsay Todd. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made our idents.
Ed Seed did our music.
Of course he
and
did.
And Emily Power did our artwork.
I bumped into Emily Power in the street the other day and I told her how much you enjoy saying her name every week.
Emily Power. Power to the Emily needs. Power.
Power to the artwork.
Power to the artwork. He's been Jeff.
He's been Ed.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.